Our next case for argument this morning is Collins versus Daniels.
Good morning. Good morning. Richard Westfall on behalf of the appellants. And with sitting me at counsel table is Blair Dunn, who was the trial counsel and also did the opening brief. May it please the court. On the night of Ms. Collins' arrest, she was 61 years of age. She was medically fragile. She had never spent a day in jail. She was put in jail late that Friday night. It's my understanding that the new rules kicked in at midnight that night. She was finally booked 2 o'clock in the morning. By that time, the schedules that are sitting out on the walls of the jail that would have allowed her to bail out and be free in a matter of hours were taken down, and she was subjected under the new New Mexico Supreme Court rules to the application of the assessment tool, the Arnold tool, which ended up as a result of events, both causing her to be in prison until Wednesday, caused her to be hospitalized.
Okay, can I ask you to clarify that? Now, you say that she was penalized because of the Arnold tool. I thought she was detained prior to her arraignment. I thought that's why she was detained, that these 2017 rules, the Arnold tool, all of those apply at the point of the arraignment, that the Arnold tool had nothing to do with why she was detained prior to the arraignment. Am I wrong?
I believe you are, Your Honor, because it's my understanding that everyone needs to be subjected to the Arnold tool on a going forward basis. And so our point is,
well, the Arnold tool only applies in the Metropolitan Court and the Second Judicial District Court, right?
The Arnold tool must be a risk assessment under the rules within 3 days prior to the determination on the conditions of release. And so everyone must be subjected to this. Ms. Collins was denied monetary bail.
So you're representing that the Arnold tool applies in every single court in New Mexico?
It's my understanding, yes.
Okay,
I mean, it took completely eviscerated her right to monetary bail. Her daughter had called up, arranged for a bail bondsman, who happens to be a member of one of our plaintiffs, and was ready to come into the jail, post the bond, and she would have been free within a matter of hours. Instead, she was jailed for the only time in her life for 5 days, because those sheets came off the wall at midnight. She was now put into the criminal justice system so that the application of the Arnold tool was mandatory. There's no more monetary bail. And as a result of that, she was kept in jail until Wednesday.
And so I respectfully where do we find the right to monetary bail?
Yes.
Where is that right found?
That right is found both under the Eighth Amendment, implicit in the excessive fines provision, and a couple of cases I'm going to recite to you in a moment, both the Leary case and the Stack versus Boyle case especially, and in the substantive and procedural components of the Due Process Clause. So the critical point, and this is a critical distinction between this case and the Third Circuit Holland case. Listen, I'm very well aware that I'm being asked to not only argue a situation where the court had granted a motion to dismiss below, where Rule 11 sanctions were issued, and I have a Third Circuit court against me. That being said, I respectfully submit to this court that there was indeed a constitutional deprivation in violation of the Eighth Amendment here, and also a violation of the Due Process Clause, because Ms. Collins was forced to spend needless days in jail and denied liberty that is protected by the Eighth Amendment and by the Due Process Clause of the Constitution.
And you're not asserting a Fourth Amendment claim, is that right?
We withdrew our Fourth Amendment claim, Your Honor. You look at the Third Circuit's decision. There's a whole discussion where the Third Circuit was very moved by the procedural protections that are part of this new bail scheme that New Jersey has and that New Mexico substantially has similar as well. You know, the application of the Arnold tool, these various procedural requirements that the state must go through. At the end of the day, there will be days of needless, in many situations, including Ms. Collins, needless incarceration while this process gets to work its way through. And I respectfully submit to this court that that is a clear violation of a clear liberty. There can be no greater, except for maybe the, you know, under the capital punishment, you know, life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Obviously, taking life is a little bit more serious. But I respectfully submit that depriving someone's liberty, especially someone who's never spent a day in jail, the charges against Ms. Collins were dropped. She was not, this is far away from, you know, anywhere kind of a Salerno situation where you're talking about dangerousness. The charges against her were dropped. She was not dangerous. She was bailable. And just because she happened to be booked 2 hours late, she was denied the ability to post monetary bail and be out within a matter of hours, well, instead of being subjected to this
counsel,
days of incarceration.
As to Ms. Collins, how would any form of relief other than damages redress the alleged injury here?
I'm sorry. My hearing aids are maybe turned up as much, but I couldn't hear your question.
I'll speak up a bit. So you've got multiple plaintiffs, but as to Ms. Collins, I'm asking about the remedy. Yep. She's asking for damages, correct?
That is one of the remedies we're seeking.
I asked what she's seeking, not what the other plaintiffs are seeking. What is there any other remedy besides damages that would redress her injury?
She's seeking damages. She's also seeking a declaration that this scheme on behalf of herself, and this is a class action, on behalf of herself and others similarly situated, unconstitutional.
There's been no class certified, has there?
No, because this was granted on a motion to dismiss.
If she were to prevail on her claim, she's just asking for damages. There is no prospective relief for her, is there?
Oh, I think I understand your question, Your Honor. She'd be asking for damages, and she would also be entitled to her attorney's fees, Your Honor.
All right.
But again, this was brought as a class action, and I think it's important to note that there would be not just Ms. Collins, but there will be hundreds, indeed, over the course of years, thousands of people who will not be dangerous, who will, prior to the New Mexico Supreme Court rules, would have been able to post jailhouse bond and be free within a matter of hours. Instead, will spend, on average, 2 to 3 days, actually probably more likely 3 days, while this Arnold tool works its way through the system, and there can be a determination of pretrial release conditions.
Can you, just going back a little bit, can you point me to anything in the complaint that alleges that the Arnold tool was in place in the court in which Ms. Collins was ultimately detained, which she was charged, which she was arraigned? Is there anything in the complaint to suggest that?
If I can, Your Honor, I will try to do, if I have any time.
Okay.
But I think it's implicit in, at least, you know, as I'm appellate counsel, I wasn't trial counsel. But I think it's at least implicit in the fact that Bernalillo County, the court, is also being brought as a defendant because they had adopted the honor tool, and that was one of the there's reasons why one of the defendants is because that Arnold tool was applied to Ms. Collins.
Well, maybe
it had to be in her jurisdiction.
Maybe there are a lot of counties in New Mexico, and there's nothing in the complaint that told me, because I really looked to see what county was she charged in or arraigned, and there's nothing in the complaint, I think, to suggest that. So, yeah, you allege. So you're saying that I should infer, because one of the counties that you ultimately included in the complaint that you've dropped on appeal, by the way, is Bernalillo County, that we should infer that she was arraigned in Bernalillo County? I'm asking you if that's.
I'm getting a nod from my trial court, so I think believe the answer to the question is yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I want to try to reserve as much time as I can, but let me get to a couple of what I consider to be some of the key salient points that I want this court to look at.
Counsel, the district court dismissed much of your case on standing and immunity grounds.
And that's correct, Your Honor.
You haven't said anything about that so far. And I'm interested in why the Bail Bond Association has standing. Relies on an injury to its members for standing, but do the members, the district court said that the injury has to be to a legally protected interest. Can you address why you think the district court was wrong?
Both first party standing under the Pierce case that in our reply brief.
Yeah, I'm talking about standing based on injury to its membership.
I don't think there's even the status.
Associational standing.
Right. Hunt associational standing. That was asserted below. And I don't think even that. And I don't even believe the trial court challenged that. In fact, the trial court only ruled on the second and third. I think the trial court essentially assumed representational standing, but said that there was not individual.
So do you think the Bail Bonds Association is still in the case as far as the district court is concerned?
I'm having trouble hearing your questions, Your Honor, and I seriously apologize.
Well, maybe I'm misreading the district court. I thought the district court said that plaintiff didn't have standing.
It said that the Bail Bonds Association did not have standing, but I don't think the basis was Hunt representational standing. I think it went into no first party, you know, the test for first party standing for third party.
Is it still in the case or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Because we're appealing the standing decision.
Well, did the district court dismiss the association for lack of standing, yes or no?
Yes, it did.
Then why do you think it has standing?
For the reasons we set forth in our briefs.
I know what's in your briefs. I'm giving you a chance.
Because under the Pierce case allows that if there's an injury that relates to a close relationship under the Pierce case, then you have first party standing and you have third party standing when you meet the three-part test for third party standing. You know, an injury in fact, clearly there's a denial of their economic interest on injury, the nature of the interest at stake, the denial of liberty, and the arguable inability of the person to, you know, the fact that her interest had been hampered.
I'm going to ask this one more time because I don't want to burn all your time, but the district court said there was not standing based on injury to its members because there was no an injury to a legally protected interest. Is that a correct statement of the law?
Your Honor, I'm not answering your question, but we're appealing decision.
I'm asking you, was the district court wrong?
Yes, Your Honor, we're asserting that the district court was wrong.
As to the specific question I just asked you.
Please repeat. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The court said that the members didn't have a legally protected interest. Is that wrong as a basis to deny
standing?
Yes, Your Honor. And why is that?
Because they had the close personal relationship with one of its members.
That's the third party standing.
No, it's my understanding the second part of the standing. If one of its members has that standing, then the association has standing. One of the members was prepared to write the bail for Ms. Collins that evening and therefore had the close personal relationship. This was not a Kowalski situation a la Holland, and clearly the Bail Bonds Association the member had standing and the association had standing in this interest.
Associational standing only works if the group, the criminal defendants charged, if you will, could not bring the case for themselves, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And here they can, obviously. Ms. Collins did.
Yes, Your Honor. I have 1 minute, and I beg the court's indulgence so I can make two critical points in 1 minute
Doesn't that disprove your associational standing argument?
Yes, but Ms. Collins has standing, and I think that that's important to know.
So that's
and given
it.
That I have.
That's it, really, isn't it? Isn't that your only plaintiff, is Ms. Collins?
Yes.
On standing?
Yes, Your Honor. May I please, I beg the court's indulgence, since I only have 48 seconds.
Okay, go ahead.
I want this court to please look at the language in Stack versus Boyle that we rely upon that's set forth at the very bottom of the beginning that's a passage that starts first from the passage of the Judiciary Act. And then if you look at the key language from Stack versus Boyle, and then you also look at the case that we cite in Leary versus United States, there is a clear acknowledgement by the U.S. Supreme Court, first in Leary in 1912, then by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1951, that the Eighth Amendment bail necessarily assumes a monetary component. In Leary, the Supreme Court acknowledged that we were going from the old personal surety system, which the Third Circuit relied upon, and said that's now no longer. And then Stack versus Boyle in 1951, the Supreme Court specifically acknowledges the modern system and then goes on to say that if you violate and do excessive bail under the modern system, you violate the Eighth Amendment. I think those, I really want to bring that to the court's attention because I think it's very important for as the court works through and assesses this case vis-a-vis the Third Circuit case. Thank you.
Did you have an opportunity to review the appellate brief in the Holland case?
I'm aware of them, yes, Your Honor.
Did you compare it to the brief that was filed in this case?
No. I can't speak for my I did not do the opening brief, so I cannot speak.
But you read it, I'm sure. You read it, I'm sure.
I'm sure, yes.
Are these briefs the same?
No. I can tell you, at least with respect to my reply brief, I wrote that one on my own, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Ari Bernoff from the New Mexico Attorney General's Office. I'm here on behalf of the New Mexico State Judiciary. I'd like to address standing very briefly first, since that was a focus of the court's inquiry with Mr. Westfall. The district court considered and correctly determined that Bail Bond Association of New Mexico lacks standing in this case, not because Bail Bond Association is incapable of representing its member companies, but because those companies don't have any legally cognizable interest in the claims advanced in the complaint. So the stray references.
But why does that go to standing? We're on a motion to dismiss. The allegation is that they've suffered economic harm, an injury in fact. And assuming that the rule has caused them to suffer economic harm, and if they can succeed, then it would be redressable. Why does it have to be a legally cognizable injury? What authority, what standing law authority do you have for that?
Your Honor, Judge Junell relied on Virginia versus American Booksellers Association for that proposition, that there needs to be a nexus between the specific interest that the organization is purportedly advancing on behalf of its members and the actual claims in the complaint. So in other words, the standing argument that the district court adopted may not have prevailed if this was a different lawsuit. If Bail Bonds Association of New Mexico, for example, brought a takings claim or some other claim for deprivation of its business interests, its stray reference to a loss of economic benefit.
It's not a stray reference. I mean, that's what they alleged. They alleged damage they say their businesses have been hurt by this rule.
Your Honor, there is no cause of action in the complaint that relates to a loss of a business interest.
So why isn't the proper disposition that they don't have a claim? They failed to state a claim.
That absolutely is a proper disposition.
As opposed to standing. I'm just trying to get some help here.
I understand, Your Honor. And we understood Judge Junell's reference to the case that I mentioned, Virginia versus American Booksellers, to require, for purposes of the standing inquiry, that there be a demonstrated connection between the claims at issue and the argument that the organization or association is speaking on behalf of its membership. In other words, Bail Bonds Association has the ability as a membership organization to speak on behalf of bail bonds companies in New Mexico if they are seeking redress for an injury to them. They did not do that here except, again, in passing, in one allegation, in one paragraph.
I understand your argument.
Okay. The last word that I'd want to say about standing is that the third party aspect of standing should also be, the district court's ruling should also be affirmed, because under Kowalski, these companies, these bail bond companies, do not have a sufficiently close relationship to potential customers, potential criminal defendants who need, in the bail bond industry's view, cash bonds. And as the court already observed, Darlene Collins is perfectly capable of vindicating her own legal interests. She's done so in this case. Moving to the merits of the district court's decision, the district court correctly determined that there is no right under the federal constitution, under the Eighth Amendment, to money bail.
I'm sorry to do this to you because I know you're anxious to move to the merits, but can you address your adversary's argument about Ms. Collins' standing, and particularly with regard to the Arnold tool and her status prior to the arraignment?
Yes, Judge Bachrach, I'll do that right now. The court, I think, knows that New Mexico judicial defendants did challenge Darlene Collins' standing below. We are not pursuing those arguments here on appeal, and so we are assuming for purposes of this argument that she does have standing. Darlene Collins, although I don't think it was pled in the complaint, was arraigned in Bernalillo County. And Bernalillo County is the only county in New Mexico where the PSA, the pretrial risk assessment, the so-called Arnold tool, is being used.
Is the Arnold tool used prior to the arraignment?
The way it works, Your Honor, is, and I believe this is set forth in Justice Daniels' affidavit that's in the record as part of our response to plaintiff's motion for preliminary injunction. The Arnold tool is employed by pretrial services of the Second Judicial District Court in concert with their counterparts in Bernalillo County Metropolitan Court. And that assessment is prepared in time for a defendant's first felony appearance or arraignment. And although I don't think it's in the record whether a pretrial assessment was prepared for Ms. Collins, I would assume that one was.
Well, okay, so I think you answered my question, but I just want to make sure. So the Arnold tool only, I take it that your answer is that the Arnold tool takes effect at the arraignment or the first appearance, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Ms. Collins, and I understand you stipulated or didn't contest your standing for Ms. Collins, but we have, an obligation sua sponte, even if it makes our skin crawl, to address you're welcome, to address standing, at least the jurisdictional component. So prior to the arraignment, is it fair to say that the Arnold tool had nothing to do with why Ms. Collins was detained prior to the arraignment?
I think that's a fair understanding. Let me put it this way, Your Honor. I don't have any contrary understanding.
And she was released at the arraignment.
She was, Your Honor, and she was released on her own recognizance with nothing more than the standard conditions that she come back to court, that she not use drugs.
And not go home.
Correct.
So can you aid us in complying with our constitutional duty to address the standing of Ms. Collins sua sponte? How did the Arnold tool affect her, Ms. Collins, at all?
Again, Your Honor, it's not pled in plaintiff's complaint, but my understanding, my inference from reading the complaint, is that the Arnold tool was used in the preparation of a risk assessment for Ms. Collins that Judge Weeks considered in reviewing Ms. Collins.
At the arraignment?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thanks.
So it affects her because she had to wait for that assessment. And really what we're talking about is delay in release.
And, Your Honor,
and the alleged right for monetary bail.
Your Honor, I think that plaintiff has pivoted over the months in now making that argument. However, that argument has nothing to do with the 2017 amendments to the Rules of Criminal Procedure, because the prior version of Rule 5401 also required that a defendant who was in local custody be arraigned and be considered for release within 3 days.
But we had the, whatever it was called, the jailhouse notice that's on the wall that says if you're charged with these minor crimes, you can bail out immediately.
Judge Briscoe, as a matter of practice,
yeah,
custodial authorities in New Mexico employed those so-called right. jailhouse bonds.
And that's, and that's the change of procedure that's troubling the plaintiff here.
And I understand that, Your Honor, and what the Supreme Court of New Mexico determined is that the practice of employing jailhouse bonds, often without any real judge, any judicial mm-hmm. officer at all, actually considering what conditions should mm-hmm. be imposed, if any, is violative of New Mexico's pre-existing rules of criminal procedure. And so Ms. Collins, to the extent that she now claims that the real injury to her is not that she was deprived of the opportunity to post a legally compliant money bond, but that she had to be in jail for 3 days, that would not be remedied by granting any of the relief that plaintiff seeks in this case, because again, even prior to the rule amendment, that 3-day limit applied. And Ms. Collins, as I understand the complaint, does not make a facial challenge to that provision of Rule 5401 that says you have to be before a judge within 3 days. I suppose she could. That case is not before the court now. And so Judge Juneau appropriately determined, and I hope it's all right that I'm circling back to the Eighth Amendment, that there is no constitutional right to monetary bail, whatever authorities may have held about the right to bail per se in the federal system under the Constitution. There's no right to what plaintiff demands here, which is to have a money bond considered on equal footing with non-monetary conditions of release. And I think that that decision by the district court is unassailable, not only because the Third Circuit in Holland came to a similar conclusion, of course this court is not bound by that decision, but because plaintiffs have never identified a single authority for the proposition that the United States Constitution requires monetary bail, as opposed to requiring some mechanism for criminal defendants pretrial to secure their release.
Well, counsel cited two cases to us saying that it was implicit in the Eighth Amendment that monetary bail should be permitted.
Your Honor, I would disagree with counsel's characterization of Stack. Certainly, Stack dealt with a payment of money, a money bail bond. I don't think that that can be stretched to support the proposition that counsel uses it for today, which is that money bond is a fundamental right. There's a couple of other clarifications that I'd like to offer in response to counsel's presentation. Darlene Collins does not, in her complaint, at least as judicial defendants read it, make any claim that she was mistreated, that she was denied access to necessary medical care. I mean, I think again, those are casual references in the complaint to her age, to her medical condition. But the actual relief that Darlene Collins seeks has nothing to do with her age or her medical condition or even the amount of time that she was in jail. I'd like to just close by asking this court to affirm Judge Juneau's determination on Rule 11 sanctions. And contrary to plaintiff's argument in their briefing, Judge Juneau did not determine that trial counsel should be sanctioned because he wrote letters or contacted the media. Judge Juneau determined that sanctions were appropriate for two reasons only. One, that Bail Bonds Association and the legislator plaintiffs failed to make any adequate inquiry into standing before bringing their claims, before joining this suit. And as a part of that, in a single reference, Judge Juneau acknowledged that he saw an improper purpose, and that was an argument that the judicial defendants made, that even as plaintiffs were apparently, counsel was apparently unable to undertake this inquiry, counsel was very active in media relations efforts. And Judge Juneau, in other words, determined that even though writing a letter or contacting the news media is not objectionable or unlawful. In fact, it's protected. In and of itself, it is evidence of why Bail Bonds Association and why the handful of legislators joined this lawsuit.
Okay. Wasn't there a third reason that Judge Janelle gave for sanctioning Mr. Dunn? And that was that with regard to immunity, that that plaintiff's counsel failed to recognize judicial immunity. And one of the arguments that your adversaries make, and I want to ask you to respond to it, is that Judge Janelle made a mistake with regard to this Arnold tool, that the Arnold tool is not the exercise of a judicial power. It's akin to exercising power, legislative power of judges, and it might be covered by a legislative immunity, but he was just flat out wrong in saying that the Arnold tool was an exercise of judicial power that would come within judicial immunity, and they argue that that's just wrong. And so that was at least part of the rationale for sanctioning Mr. Dunn. Why shouldn't we reverse based on that technical error?
Your Honors, may I answer this question? I think I have just about 10 seconds left.
Yes.
Okay. I apologize if I was unclear. The two reasons for imposing Rule 11 sanctions, I hadn't gotten to the second reason, Judge Bachrach, yet. The first reason was the deficiencies, the fatal deficiencies in standing and the failure to argue for any reversal or change in existing law in that respect. The second reason was, just as you said, Judge Bachrach, that judicial defendants are absolutely immune from claims for money damages. It's astonishing to me that plaintiffs continue to press this point. The only authority that they cite in support of this argument that the district court got it wrong is a U.S. Supreme Court case that did not authorize money damages against judges, that authorized declaratory relief where judges were acting as a state Supreme Court.
Well, would the enactment of the Arnold tool fall within judicial immunity or legislative immunity?
The claims in this complaint, Your Honor, against the state Supreme Court are against the court for promulgating the rules, not for implementing the Arnold tool. The claims which Judge Junell dismissed
on... What about the claim against the chief judge of the Second Judicial District?
Judge Junell dismissed those claims on 12b-6 grounds. I don't read Judge Junell's Rule 11 order to reach that question. But I think that it's fair to say that the Second Judicial District Court and Bernalillo County Metropolitan Court were brought into this suit because of their implementation of the Arnold tool.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. We'll take a 15-minute break at this time and return to hear arguments in Romero.